Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Janet Groth, in the year 1957, was a graduate of the University of Minnesota, and she landed a job at the New Yorker. And it's a great story, which we'll hear in just a moment, how she landed that job. She didn't expect to stay long at the reception desk, but say she did for 21 years, and you can imagine some of the people she met and dined with and had problems with and took care of people's dogs and their apartments, etc. But simultaneously, she was also getting her PhD, and she is a very accomplished professor and writer herself. It's just there's a question that you have at the beginning of the story. She has all this talent. She was the receptionist for 21 years. Should she not have been advanced? But it was a different era. She's a former Fulbright lecturer in Norway, a visiting fellow at Yale, a professor emeritus of English at Plattsburgh State University of New York, and teaches at Columbia University School of Continuing Education. She is the author of Edmund Wilson, A Critic for Our Time. Also other books on Wilson, including Critic and Love, A Romantic Biography of Edmund Wilson. And we're going to be welcoming phone calls for Janet Groth. She is the author of her time at The New Yorker, and the book is titled The Receptionist, An Education at The New Yorker. Janet Groth is our guest. Our phone number, may I remind you, is 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. And you can also leave messages for us on our Facebook page, which is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Janet Groth, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Kathleen. This is a wonderful opportunity.
Oh, I'm glad to have you with us. You know, I'm with your life, though, when you were 19 and 20 years old, which was a while ago. So I'm thinking of you as this young woman now as we talk. But you must tell the beginning of the story of how you graduated. You had this brief job with CBS, and this guy knew E.B. White. And it's just a, you know, it's just the luck of the draw.
Of the planets, do you think?
I think so.
In any case, I was finishing in August my bachelor's degree, and I heard that there was going to be a balloon flight out of the Mesabi Range, actually. It was a precursor of those stratospheric flights. And CBS was sending out a science show to cover it, and I was hired as their Gal Friday. That was my one contact with anybody in New York, knowing that I wanted to go there after finishing my degree. And since I just had, I was all primed and sent my resume to Arthur Ziegart, the writer-director of Little Science Show. He got that resume, I still don't understand how, when he was in Maine with his dear friend E.B. White.
Hmm.
Now, Mr. White never saw anybody. He was terribly shy. The last thing he wanted to do was to talk to a girl from Iowa who was looking for a job. But maybe his esteem for Arthur Ziegart was such that he decided, okay, why not? And I was told to come in to the New Yorker and be interviewed by him. So there we were.
There you were, and you were asked if you were typed. Yes. I can't believe it. Here you are. I mean, you're a very accomplished young woman at that point. You're deeply versed in literature.
Yeah, I'd won some prizes for my college writing and so on. And he saw all that in the resume, but this was 1957, and when you saw a young woman in that position, the question was, can you type? My answer was very fateful because I said no. Therefore was ruled out of the typing pool. And I think he had some sympathy for that. But neither of us could have known that it meant that I would stay at my entry-level reception desk for 21 years.
Yeah. Well, but you did, and look at what's happened as a result of that. I was wondering, and we'll get to all the personalities, but you also got a PhD, and you have taught all over the world, and you knew your literature long before you even went on for your PhD, when I look at all the conversations you had with some of the writers. So were you going to school at night?
That's right. At that time, NYU was the top university offering night classes. Therefore, it was NYU, and I began that in 68. So I was already at the magazine for a good long time before the master's degree came up. And even then, I don't know, it would have taken how long it would have taken me since I took quite long enough. But I was paying, I didn't understand that you could go in for a student loan. So I was taking one course at a time and paying for it out of my $80 a week salary. But there was always literature. I was steeped in literature. I called myself the English major of all time.
So you, of course, were at the right magazine then, even if it was a receptionist position. I love this woman who, when you first got the job, she was just excited that you were a Midwesterner, because those Eastern girls had to have a stern talking to about their behavior and their conduct. They must have been wild, huh?
That was Daisy Terry. And, of course, her prejudice was showing. Girls from Sarah Lawrence knew perfectly well how to dress, even with the decorum that Miss Terry would require. However, she decided that I would have a little more sense than some of those. I think she called them Westchester County and Connecticut girls who come through this office.
You met some people and became, I love the conversations that you had about people like James Joyce and the Bible and the New Testament. I was really impressed how well-versed you were, Janet, when you were very young. You really knew your literature.
Well, I had been spending most of my teenage years, when I ought to have been socializing, with a very athletic-minded high school in southern Minnesota, who were all sort of basketball crazy, and they were being so-called brain. I did spend a lot of my high school years in an armchair reading, so that perhaps accounts for it.
Let's talk about John Berryman, a tortured soul in many ways,
but
you became very good friends, and you had long lunches together where you really talked about life and death.
Well, the long lunches perhaps were more indicative of my relationship with Joseph Mitchell, but John Berryman certainly took me to lunch, and whenever he was in New York. But he was still based at the University of Minnesota, where I had first met him as my professor, and been tapped largely because I was sitting next to a brilliant student that he wanted to have coffee with after class. Those little discussions led to his further relationship with me. When he found me at the New Yorker, he would come in to talk to Louise Bogan, who was the poetry editor, and found that I was working there. And at that time, he was between wives, I think between his second and third wife, looking desperately, I think, would not put too fine a point on it, for someone. And it turned out that he was proposing a lot to to whoever came his way. And I was among the happy many, and probably the lucky ones who said no, because it was not easy. He was not an easy man, but a wonderful professor and a fabulous poet.
Mm-hmm. And it must have been a marvelous professor, because I recall you saying at some point in the book that Saul Bellow had to fill in for him one day, and you were disappointed that you had Bellow. No,
Can
I can't imagine it. Really.
No, we were all thrilled when our man came back.
Yeah. And part of the reason was that you were gracious, but you were also a knockout, weren't you?
Well,
it's all right. You can
modestly,
say it.
Yeah. if only one could stay in those youthful years. But those were my good years, yes. And I was blessed with a blonde ponytail, which seemed to knock out a few male perceivers. So there we were.
Mm-hmm. And Joseph Mitchell, he was the one with whom you talked about James Joyce.
Those long lunches and those biblical references. I wonder if your readers or your listeners might want a little intro for Joseph Mitchell, who is so highly thought of by the other New Yorker writers that upon his death, the New Yorker gave 5 pages of tributes to him from other writers covering 3 generations of New Yorker contributors who simply thought of him as the New Yorker writer to model themselves. Mm.
What did you think?
I thought he was wonderful, and he was so troubled that he suffered a monumental writer's block. I believe there must have been some sort of unspoken bond between those of we were both blocked in our own ways, and those lunches when we talked Joyce and talked the Bible and talked about, well, as I say, we very often talked about death. They were deep discussions. They were very precious to me, and I think it happened again as a kind of a convergence of two people passing in the night, if you will.
Mm-hmm. And you, did you feel, because it really appeared to me that you were being treated as an equal, that there wasn't necessarily this sexual exchange going on. It was an exchange of literary ideas.
That was one of the fabulous things about my friendship with Joe. He simply never indicated in any way that we were not peers talking together about our mutual love for James Joyce. It was true.
Mm-hmm.
And very important to me.
And you talk about, and we'll go on to other people you knew, but there's this theme of being a tortured soul that seems to run through a lot of these people.
They're heavy
drinkers. John committed suicide.
Yes.
Why?
Oh, I think Edmund Wilson put his finger on it when he was writing about the wound and the bow. He wrote about all of these sufferings in childhood for one reason or another that sensitized people who were already gifted in words and literary expression, and they found their outlet in writing in some way. So that was an outlet, yes, but the troubles and the demons pursued them, you see, and I was in a position to see them as they struggled with those demons.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt very, well, I suppose you could say I did feel like one of them. And only later, only after many years of my own struggle, was I able to perhaps join them in some small way as a writer myself.
Yeah. Another, you had, a lot of these people had, were thinking of getting married, or you thought that maybe they were going to marry you, and there were all these other relationships
often
going on.
Often mistakenly, I'm sorry to say.
Right.
until that wonderful Al late in the day came along. But yes, there was the cartoonist. Is that one of the things
yes.
you're thinking about?
Yes.
Well, the one time that I was not in the 18th floor precinct at my reception desk, I was promoted to the art department, as they called the cartoon department around the New Yorker. And for 6 months I was there helping to send back the rejects of the thousands and thousands of hopefuls who sent in things that they thought would make a wonderful New Yorker cartoon. And, of course, only one in a million ever got through and into the magazine. So there were lots and lots of reasons to employ people to go through the so-called slush pile. And there I was for about 6 months. But I was not a good fit with the director at that time, a man named James Garrity, who liked his previous assistant very much better. She was a no-nonsense woman with a British accent and very little sympathy expressed for these guys. The cartoonists who came in weekly to have their roughs decided upon and bought or other not bought. She would never entertain an idea that they should have another chance for this particularly wonderful rough that they thought would make the great cartoon. She was Brenda, and she worked with James Garrity in a way that I never did, so that when I went away to Europe for my first vacation, I came back to find Brenda reinstated. Hmm. And myself back on the 18th floor for another 19 years.
Oh, my gosh. It's hard to believe it was that long. Yeah. So tell us about Evan, because it's a complicated story, and you really started facing some demons of your own.
Well, that's true. There was, at that time, among the newer generation of cartoonists, he was not regularly bought, but he was often hired to draw someone else's gag, and so he had a kind of a second-tier B-team aura about him, and it was added to his defensive stance in life. Also, he was not terribly attractive, and he thought that in order to get the girl, he just had to try harder. So laying siege to me, the new girl in the art department, seemed to be a matter of taking many, many rebuffs, and then I can only call it laying siege until he was successful, partly by suggesting to me that we would make beautiful children together and kind of hold out the prospect of marriage. So when that was exploded in a fairly dramatic way, do you want to hear how
Please,
it exploded?
Yes, yes.
Oh, dear.
Yes, I do.
Well, we had been going together for through the period that I left for my trip to Europe. That was 6 months, I suppose, we'd seen each other. And when I came back and was sent down to in any case, he asked me to view an apartment that he thought he needed my opinion of. And I thought it was to be our apartment, you see. We went down to Washington Square. Washington Square! Henry James lived on Washington Square. It's down in the village. It's very charming. The apartment itself was dark and small, but he asked my opinion. And the woman who was showing it to us, the landlady, said, "It's so good of you, Miss Groth, to come down and give the woman's point of view to Mr. Sim. When was it you said your fiancé would be arriving from Austria? Was it December? Well, I'm going to have a deposit if I'm going to keep this apartment." He took me back into the rear bedroom because I was about to, I don't know whether I was going to slug him or faint, but I was certainly reacting to this bombshell. I said, fiance, and he said, "Oh, what tangled webs we weave when first we practice to deceive." Mm. I thought, well, how can he even think of that quote in a time like this? But he did. That's what he said.
He had an incredible amount of gall, didn't he? Oh my goodness.
Yes, he did, and he had picked a good. I suppose at that time I might have had victim stamped all over me. I was, after all, the naive girl from the Midwest, but I was older and wiser, and went into a kind of a tailspin as a result of that. And I don't know if we need to suggest to the reader that they're going to have a little episode in Bellevue as a result of a suicide attempt, and a lot of analysis that followed to get me to see some perspective on just what I was doing, you know, and how I was not in touch with my own feelings. I didn't care for this man in the same way that someone should who's going to marry them. Was he going to marry me, you see? And then when he didn't, oh, well, I must be no good. I have to toss myself into the trash.
And what did you do with all of your talent during that time? Were you giving short stories to people?
Well, I was writing. Oh, no, I was working on a novel, and some of the people that I trusted around the office who were also, in an office life in New York, or most people are working on a novel, or were at that time. And so I shared that news with at least one of the people on the 18th floor, Paul Brodeur, and he put me in touch with a very fine person who was starting their own publishing. They looked at a couple of chapters of the book, which was, I can tell you, it was about the experiences that I was having with Evan Sim. Mm. And he said, oh, these are very impressive. I look forward to seeing more. But instead of showing him more, I showed them to my professor out at Minnesota on a trip back home. And he lowered the boom on me. He said, I used to admire very much those stories you wrote in college for me, with their honesty and their perception and their humanity. He said, these people, I wouldn't want any reader to spend a minute with these people. He said, I noticed that you're smoking now with a cigarette holder. You're even writing with a cigarette holder. So I think he was right. You know, I took that manuscript to my parents' home, looked it over, and threw it in the garbage. And that was the end of my dream of being a novelist. And to a large extent, I did pack. It was like, I don't know, I thought I was a Henry James heroine, renouncing my hopes for literary fame, and turning my attention again to not very fruitful efforts to find the right man.
Well, welcome phone calls if you would like to join our conversation. There might be some of you. The book is just out, so I don't know if you've had a chance to read it, but of course you're familiar with The New Yorker, and many of you probably avid readers during the time that our guest, Janet Groth, was receptionist at The New Yorker. She just has a fascinating story. It's partially because of the time. 1957 is when she started there, and the role of women and her phenomenal talent. She was really a substantial writer herself, but she stayed as a receptionist for 21 years and took care of taking messages. At least she wasn't in the typing pool, taking messages and walking dogs and watching houses and being a house sitter and sometimes taking care of children, etc., for some of the very famous and probably tortured souls who worked at The New Yorker. So we're welcoming phone calls. Let me give you the phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, or you can leave a message on our Facebook page, and that is The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tomorrow during this time period, well, let me tell you about tomorrow. Tomorrow is the 4th of July, so we thought we would run a couple of the shows that we really liked a whole lot, and they're, politics, and they seemed appropriate to re-air. Some of you didn't have a chance to hear them the first go-around, so we'll re-air them on the 4th of July so that I can go with my family to... Actually, we've done this for years and years and years. I'm sure we all have traditions. I go to Illinois, and it was my father's best friend, business partner, high school football player friend, and they worked together for years and years and years. So we have remained friends with their children, and now their children have children, and their children children have children, so it's like five generations, so it takes on a new meaning. So that's where I'm going tomorrow, and but we will during the 10 o'clock hour tomorrow. This was a really moving interview for me. Clint Hill, former special agent, United States Secret Service, who was assigned to Jackie Kennedy in November of 1960 and was with her until the assassination of her husband, Mrs. Kennedy and Me, an intimate memoir. We're going to air that tomorrow. And then at 9, the author of Almost President, The Men Who Lost the Race But Changed the Nation, profiles a dozen men the author argues have run for the American presidency and lost, but who have had a huge impact. So that's coming up. 800-486-8655. Janet Groth is with us now. Her book is The Receptionist in Education at The New Yorker. And our first caller is Jim in Milwaukee. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Jim.
Are you there, Jim? I don't know what happened to you. Call us back, Jim, and we'll be happy to talk to you. We need to move on to another one of the figures in this book, and what a complicated story this one is. I loved your writing about Muriel Spark.
Ah, well, that's nice to hear. I wonder how many of your listeners either read The Prime of Miss Jean Brodie when it ran in The New Yorker or as a novel, or perhaps saw it either as a stage play or in a film with Maggie Smith. Mm-hmm. But it was The Prime of Miss Jean Brodie that brought her to The New Yorker, and she later hired me as her private secretary, which led to a long and I call it a slender but remarkable relationship.
Mm-hmm. And tell us, please, about the time that you were in, tell us about, let's start with the people who become, I don't know how you describe them. They're people who love great literature, but they have a whole set of fans, really, that you were dealing with, but it's not a typical kind of fan.
Because Muriel Spark was a convert to Catholicism, she had a subset of fans who were on their way to the priesthood, and they thought that it would be just wonderful if Muriel Spark would come to their ordinations. And one of my major tasks was somehow to let them down easy about and protect her from all of these, as she called them, priestlings who were rapping on her door.
And you went to visit her, was it in Italy?
It was in a wonderful 13th century church that was being renovated by Muriel and her companion of many years, a Scotswoman who was a sculptor and a painter named Penelope Jardine. She is still living there, and it is a perfectly beautiful location. I was invited because I was having a sabbatical year by that time. I think we're talking about 1989. I remember it was the year that the Berlin Wall fell. Mm. I was to have Christmas dinner at their residence in outside of Orvieto. Well, what a treat that was. And at the same time, things did not work out quite as we had planned, because among the guests was an antiques dealer named Freddie Fuchs, who had a kind of predilection maybe for mischief. At the time we were eating our plum pudding, he said, "I wonder if anybody saw that nasty crack about Muriel that was in the October issue of Harper and Queen." Well, Muriel, who had always been terribly sweet to me, but I knew that people thought she had a rather darker side, she was on this case. And for the rest of that particular Christmas, things were darkened by her her suggestion that she was, A, going to get the person who said that nasty crack, perhaps by opening her hinged ring as the Borgias did and dropping a little venom into any champagne glass that she could get within reach of this person, or leave Italy altogether, because if things are going to be said of that kind about me, I shall get right out, she said.
Why did she choose you for her private secretary?
Well, I was handy. I was there on the 18th floor where she had taken over a very wonderful corner office and decorated it with antique rugs and making it look much more luxurious than any of the other offices around. Anyhow, I think there was something. She had come from I think maybe even her father was a storekeeper, as was mine. Oh. And we saw in one another persons from humble beginnings who were in these august quarters. She, of course, as a celebrity in her own right, and I simply eager to see that she could do her work and that I could keep people away so that she could do it.
Mm. Jim is with us now, I believe. Hi, Jim.
Hello.
Yes, go ahead, Jim.
Yes, I was just wondering how she handled the 60s movement. In New York. She was just a young girl and in New York for about 10 years, and then this big hippie movement in Woodstock. And I wonder how the New Yorker people felt about that, or were they a little more
conservative? Well, we were a little slow off the mark, Jim, to tell you the truth. If Tom Wolfe hadn't written his piece about the mummified museum on 43rd Street, which is where the New Yorker had its offices, I don't know how quickly the 60s or the changes of adding a rock critic, who was Ellen Willis, of course, and opening up the talk of the town to people like George Trow and Jamaica Kincaid, who started covering roller derbies in the Bronx. There were changes that the New Yorker made, but whether they would have made them as quickly, perhaps putting Charlene Hunter, whose name at that time was Charlene Hunter, on their payroll and adding a number of other African Americans. There was Jacob Brackman. There was Rick Hertzberg. Terrence Malick even put in a few months at least. You know who Terrence Malick is? He's just done Tree of Life, that movie that divided everybody into pros and cons. Anyway, I was there and trying to adjust. In fact, it was at a women's group talking that we discovered that of the seven women who were talking about men's difficulty with commitment, John Barrowman came up and was listed as an example of overcorrection because among seven of us, he'd proposed to three of us.
Oh, my. Jim, thank you very much for the call. Marilyn in Washburn. Hi, Marilyn.
Hi. Janet, I can't wait to read your book.
Thank you so
much. And I guess my question is, I think about the New Yorker's bravery in writing of things that really mattered. And you earlier mentioned a guy who literally saved my life, Paul Brodeur. You mentioned him, and I hadn't thought of him for about 3 or 4 years. And when he wrote the things about electromagnetic fields and the health effects, and then he eventually turned into a book, and when you mentioned him as being such a kind, good person, I can't wait to read your book, and I'm really happy that you were friends of Paul Brodeur, and I'm just curious about what
Thank
he was
you.
Like
I'm
as
very,
a person.
I'm very, very fond of Paul, though he would be the first to tell you that in his own view, one of the principal requirements for being an investigative reporter of the kind that he was, blowing the whistle on asbestos and on radiation, were to be a kind of paranoid figure and to be so skeptical of the corporate world that he would go after them with the passion that he does. But in person, he was, of course, a pussycat and very, very nice to me.
Hmm. Thank you, Marilyn, so much for the call. Jeff in Superior. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, good morning. Say, I have a general question. I hope you don't think it's silly, but as a writer, I mean, do you have like a favorite turn of phrase, and what do you think about language? Do you have words that you like to use, or you've seen over the years
different
words come and go?
Oh, that's a wonderful question. Just a wonderful question.
Some favorites that you like to
use? Well, we try to stay away from from the demon issues and although I sometimes put quotes around it, I do say that perhaps my story would have been different if there had been such a thing as Oprah and assertiveness training, and I do suggest that maybe one of my problems was issues of self-esteem, but staying away from those phrases is probably a good way to proceed as a writer. I'm sure you appreciate the fact that Dorothy Parker named her poodle Cliché. and maybe this is a good place to tell that little story about
yes.
my having been at a book party for St. Clara McKelvey, and Dorothy Parker was in the last years of her life. She was certainly being surrounded by adoring people on a couch in the corner of the room with her ever-present poodle at her side. But she at that point was. She did drink an awful lot more than she should have, probably. Her eyes were sort of glassy as a result, or teary, I describe them. But and she seemed to be sometimes allowing her head to droop onto her lace collar. But at late in the party, I went over and took a place. My high heels were making my feet hurt. I took a place next to her on the couch. I said some nice things to her about enjoying her work. She may have muttered something. And then there was an open box of dog biscuits on the coffee table in front of us. And I took one and said, "Do you want a biscuit, cliche?" And she, her head came up. She said, "It's Bicky. Who do you think you are, Henry James?" Well, little did I know that dog biscuits were known among the literati only by Bicky.
Oh.
So I corrected myself, and the party went on. But I knew that I had been put down by the queen of the game.
Oh.
And to answer your more serious question, and I do think it's a wonderful question about language. Everybody that I knew who was a serious writer at the magazine, and certainly I think of myself as one of them, cared deeply about finding that mot juste, that Flaubertian right word for everything.
Mm-hmm.
Does that help?
Are you there, Jeff?
Ah, we've lost it, but
it
think it's a good. I think it's a good tip.
And what about? It's interesting, and I find this is true of interviews too. That you can interview people who are at the height of power, and they're very easy to talk to, and others who you feel are you're being put down by, as you called her, the queen of the game. Did you find that more often than not, that people who were enormously talented knew they were and found occasions to make you feel less than worthwhile, or was it quite the opposite generally?
Well, I talk a lot about Menschlichkeit, which I think is a wonderful word, and it's Yiddish, I think, in origin. It's humanity, but it's more like being in touch with the fact that no matter who you're talking to, it's a human being. Be a mensch. There's a kind of perception of that among the people who were able to overlook my lowly position and treat me as a human being. And there was quite a sharp division between the people like that, people who I like to spend most of my time on in the book, and those who still give me the freeze out, because after all, I was only the receptionist.
Mm-hmm. And tell me about the other movement that's taking place in your life. At what point do you start really flourishing as a professor, as a writer yourself? When does that happen?
Yes. Well, I would perhaps not have been as sharply aware of it as my senior editor, a wonderful woman at Algonquin Books called Amy Gash, who should get a nod from me, because she's the one who found my chapter, which was late in my original manuscript, about having buried this receptionist idea way back in the rear of the book, after I dealt with everybody I thought people would really like to know about. And she said, "Your story ought to be right up front, and this ought to be the receptionist."
Wow.
So thereby hangs a tale. Anyway, Amy certainly helped me in seeing that the trip to Greece was the turnaround. She said, when you stopped pushing everything to the back and started looking at yourself in something like an honest perspective, it's called Greece, the Voyage In, actually, and it comes later in the book, and it talks about my examination of my origins in Iowa and how many repercussions might have been reverberating through all those years of lack of aggressiveness in my own behalf, stemmed from feeling as the child of an alcoholic. Mm-hmm. Out in Iowa, it's a very small town where people were not in the 40s and 50s particularly tolerant of the town drunk or of their families, and I just absorbed a kind of a scornful, I think all of that shrinking from public attention, which I manifested for so many years, and I think you can see I've overcome now. Anyway,
yes.
that goes way back, and I came back from that trip to Greece in '65. Began really working with my analyst, really going on for the PhD, and. From there on in, you could say there was a turning point.
So when you take that chunk of time that you were the receptionist, do you feel a great deal of anger about the fact that you weren't allowed to use all of that talent that you had then, or do you see yourself just as a woman in that time, and that's just the time in which you lived?
I think the latter, really, and also accepting the fact that given my own contributions to the thing, I may actually have come out the winner rather than the victim. There's a little passage that I like at the end of the book in which I sum up what the receptionist received, and in addition to the very small salary, I received all of these intangibles. You know, these wonderful relationships with
yes.
the wider world and with the people who are writing about it so well, and I went to Europe all those times, and I like to make a joke that if the New Yorker was exploiting my passive dependency, they paid handsomely to rid me of it, because they paid my very expensive bills with the psychoanalyst.
Mm-hmm.
They had to have, I hasten to say, in those days, they had a wonderful insurance policy that covered everybody on the editorial staff, because so many of those tortured souls were going to shrink.
Right.
There we are.
It was a prime medical benefit.
Indeed,
that's funny.
Yes, yes.
Well, and how many places can you go to? There are just a handful of jobs where you can associate yourself with people who are beautiful writers and really know literature, and you go out to lunch and talk about Joyce and the Bible. And I mean, how many? Where else can you have that?
You don't blame me for staying as long as I did.
No, I don't. No, I understand. I understand that you did. I want to go back to the cartoonists for a moment.
Yes.
Did they feel that they were in, because a lot of people, as you well know, myself included, I think, I always look at the back page because I always want to win the contest, as many people do. But the cartoons are such a defining, in addition to the marvelous writing, they're such a defining part of the magazine. Did they feel like they were big deals, those who were regular cartoonists?
Oh, well, there was quite an understanding that to many of the subscribers and the persons who looked at the New Yorker and knew of the New Yorker, it may have begun, and we shall, dare we say, sometimes ended with their leafing through the cartoons. Yes, they did quite understand that. It didn't help them with the tough art director, James Garrity, who insisted that this one would be bought and that one would not. But he kept a very high standard, and everybody realized that the world at large knew the New Yorker, first, at least, and maybe only through its cartoons, yes.
Mm-hmm. What did they pay for a cartoon?
Very well, they paid for just in those days, for the gag itself, $50.
Huh.
And I can't give you there was a very arcane and Byzantine sliding scale that paid Charles Adams more for a bought cartoon than it would have Evan Sim, for example. Not particularly fair, maybe, but understanding who was most valuable to the magazine. And even I cannot disclose the mysteries of the pay scale for the New Yorker in those days. Perhaps it's all changed now. I don't know.
Here's an email that's come in from Sandra. I've been reading the collected works of Walcott Gibbs, Sentences Backwards Ran. He died in 58, but she says she wonders if Professor Groth had any anecdotes about him.
I was so sorry not to know Wolcott Gibbs. He, when he did work at the New Yorker, there was this sharp division between the 18th floor and the people that I knew well because they were on so-called my floor, and those few offices that were on 20, Gibbs being among them. But he died, you know, rather early in the situation. What was going on was that Susan Lardner was writing in Talk of the Town, unsigned Talk of the Town pieces about one of Wolcott Gibbs's daughters, Janet Gibbs, who was very open about her schizophrenia and her, or I didn't know, sorry, it was manic depression, but her manic phases would get quasi-comical coverage in Talk of the Town in the late 60s and 70s. And that's my one connection with the Gibbs family. That and the fact that I went to Fire Island one time and found myself reminiscing with people at a bar where Gibbs very often drank. He had a place on Fire Island.
And what about Talk of the Town? Did you imagine yourself contributing to Talk of the Town at some point?
Well, I had one talk story. They had run tongue-in-cheek stories about the arcane kinds of weird critical movements that were going through the Modern Language Association in those days. And since I was at that time already teaching at Brooklyn College in the night, well, I did a stint in the day college. Anyway, I went to the MLA, wrote a talk story, my one submission, and then I was too wimpish, I suppose you would say, to see why it wasn't running, what Mr. Shawn was saying about it. And when I did get up the nerve to ask Mary Painter, and I do fault her for this, she was his gatekeeper at that time, said, "Oh, it got lost in the bottom of a pile, and sorry, it's no longer timely." Do we all feel cringing?
Yes, we do. More phone calls in just a moment. Our guest this hour is Janet Groth, author of The Receptionist and Education at The New Yorker. She was a receptionist for 21 years. She is emeritus professor of English at the State University of New York at Plattsburgh. She's taught at Vassar, Brooklyn College, the University of Cincinnati, and Columbia. She was a Fulbright lecturer in Norway and a visiting fellow at Yale. And she is also author of Critic in Love, a Romantic Biography of Edmund Wilson. She is author of Edmund Wilson, a Critic for Our Time. 800-486-8655, the number. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. 800-486-8655, our number. Allison in Plum Lake. Hi, Allison.
Hi there.
Hi.
I'm really excited about reading this book. I can't wait. I don't know if they have it available up here. But I'm 55 and was writing at a young age, about 10, poetry and painting and all sorts of things in the arts. I was a very shy child. And my brother was always really critical of my writing. I think in retrospect he was jealous because he was a smart, he's now a doctor. He's a science guy, math guy. But I had run-ins at Mills College. I went to a women's college in California. I had, about when I was in my 20s, and back in Chicago, I had professors come on to me at film school, professors come on to me in acting and directing classes. And then I had a famous literati in Chicago who was helping me write get my poetry published. He asked me to marry him, and it completely threw me. And so between my brother's criticism and this guy coming on to me after 2 years of meeting with me to talk about my writing really shut me down. And I think it's wonderful that you've worked at Vassar and all these other places, because I was born in 1957. My mother went to Wellesley and graduated in 48. So if anybody had the, you know, audacity to try and get out there and do her own thing, it would have been me. People would have thought that of me. But it still shut me down.
Janet.
Allison, I respond, this is incredible. I think maybe you are my reader, for sure, and I hope that the book is of use to you and of value to you, but I think everything that you describe is so familiar to me, and I know so well what happened with your brother, what happened when you felt those role models, the moving out of their idealized position and into the position of the guy who just wants to get what he can. I think maybe women, young women today are in exactly the same position that we were, and we are separated by a generation, if I understand it. It's going on, is it not? Still, perhaps there are other women who would like to say, but I must say that there are men who have responded to the book who, sensitive, wonderful, evolved men who seem to feel that it gives them a kind of a privileged look into female reactions and responses, into just how deeply disabused we are of our idealism by these experiences.
Mm. And actually, as I was reading the book, I thought there is something unique about this, too. You have a unique story because you write so beautifully and you're so accomplished, and yet you have this story of being this beautiful blonde who people knew the substance of you, but they also didn't know it. It's just an interesting, you're unique, I think.
As far as I know, it may be the first time that one of us has crawled out from under the woodwork.
Yes. Well, I'm glad you did.
Thank you so much
for being with us.
Thank you, Kathleen.
Our guest this hour, and her book is The Receptionist, An Education at the New Yorker. Janet Groth is the name of her book, or is the name of her name, and that's the name of her book, which has just been released. Thanks to Brett Jaspers for producing the hour. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. Tomorrow, during this time period, we will hear from Clint Hill, former special agent, U.S. Secret Service, assigned to Jackie Kennedy in November of 1960 and with her for a year, up until a year after the president died. So, have a good 4th, everybody. Thanks for listening.